Good afternoon, everybody. It's been just an amazing, amazing socialism conference. So I just want to start by thanking all of the organizers, and especially thanking Sean Larson, and also Sherry Wolf. I teach at Rutgers in the history department, and this year we won an incredible union contract. And I've been at Rutgers for 15 years, and I have to say this year may have been my absolute happiest. So I would like to give Sherry Wolf a round of applause, because she was an absolutely tireless, committed organizer who was responsible for this victory in no small part, along with Deepa Kumar, who's also in the audience. Can we give them a round of applause? So I'm actually going to read, but I wanted to talk a little bit about why I wrote this piece. So I've been thinking about the idea of racial capitalism and how to use it as a mode of analysis. So thinking about it more broadly, I think it's a kind of analytic frame that's very relevant for the kinds of discussions that we've been having at Socialism 2019 in particular. So especially thinking about traditions of third world Marxism, you know, a kind of corpus of thought that grows out of the Global South and out of the writings of African Americans and other non-white populations living in Europe and the United States. So just thinking about these alternate trajectories for how we talk about capitalism, in which we put race at the center and the experience of non-white populations and populations of the Global South, center them in our analysis. So one of the things that kind of inspired writing this piece was trying to bring together some of the writings that have been done on public health along with the writings of the drug war. So I think it's a more general problem that often our forms of analysis are siloed, and the ways that people approach the questions of the opioid crisis has often been contrasted, for example, with the crack era and the Reagan era war on drugs. And I wanted to bring those two together. So rather than talking about them as contrasting examples, I wanted to do just the opposite. I wanted to bring them together and think, how can we fit this in a larger framework of racial capitalism? And just deal with the core contradiction of the United States, that we built this enormous edifice to punish the illicit drug economy, most importantly marijuana, but also other substances as well, while having a completely deregulated hyper-capitalist marketing of illicit drugs. So how do those two things actually fit together? Two facts for me stood out the most about this. So the United States consumes 80% of the world's opioids, even though it has only 5% of the world's population. And I'm currently writing a book on the crack and the war on drugs in Los Angeles. And from the passage of the Clinton Crime Bill in 1994, from the passage of the Anti-Drug Abuse Act under Ronald Reagan in 1988, which enshrined the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity for crack versus powder cocaine, through the passage of Clinton's crime bill in 1994, not a single white person was convicted of a federal crack offense. So I think both of these are remarkable facts. But what I'm going to try to do today is fit them together and think, how do they relate to each other? And the core of this is thinking about a framework of licit and illicit, you know, bringing these two things together, breaking down that line between legal and illegal, and thinking about overall how racial capitalism helps to shape both the overconsumption of opioids and the hypercriminalization of illicit drugs. In March 2018, President Donald Trump delivered a 45-minute speech about the crisis of addiction and overdose in New Hampshire. Flanked by a media wall with the words, opioids, the crisis next door, Trump read blankly from the teleprompter, recounting the different contributions to the current drug epidemic, including pharmacists, physicians, dealers, makers, and manufacturers. The address droned on mechanically, until finally he reached the venomous crescendo, focusing on local law enforcement's interdiction of 1,500 pounds of fentanyl. The president brightened as he shifted focus to three of his most hated enemies. First, blaming China and Mexico for saturating the US with deadly synthetic opioids, then moving seamlessly to what he considered the greatest internal threat. Quote, "My administration is also confronting things called sanctuary cities," Trump declared. "Ending sanctuary cities is crucial to stopping the drug addiction crisis." Like so many of Trump's proclamations, this rhetoric is sheer political fantasy. Since the late 1990s, the largest number of overdoses and deaths can be traced not to illicit trade or illegally imported fentanyl, but rather to legal white market pharmaceuticals. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, between 1999 and 2017, overdoses killed over 400,000 people, with 68% of those deaths linked to prescription medications. And I would add, this does not deal with the combinations of medications, so these are only direct deaths from opioids, not combinations of different pharmaceutical drugs. So for example, mixing opioids with benzodiazepines or with antidepressants, if you were to include that, the numbers would be infinitely larger. Moreover, as regulators and drug companies tighten controls on diversion and misuse after 2010, the American Society of Addiction Medicine determined that at least 80% of, quote, new heroin users started out misusing prescription painkillers. Some data sets point to even higher numbers. In a response to a 2014 review of people undergoing treatments for opioid addiction, 94% of people surveyed said that they had turned to heroin because prescription opioids were, quote, far more expensive and hard to obtain. Reimagining the opioid crisis as the product of Mexican and Central American migration, rather than the deregulation of big pharma and the systemic failures of a highly restricted, segmented private healthcare system, reveals how racial tropes continue to animate punishment regimes while simultaneously absolving one of the most lucrative and politically influential business lobbies in the United States. When I started researching this, I didn't realize this, but Big Pharma is actually the single biggest lobby in Washington, D.C., larger even than the defense contractors. A core paradox animates drug policy in the U.S. In a country that consumes over 80% of the world's opioids while composing only 5% of its population, we have simultaneously incarcerated millions of people for low-level drug possession and sale, with the vast majority being incarcerated for marijuana offenses. Since the drug war's inception through 2009, more than 31 million people have been arrested for drug offenses. In 2018, drug offenses were responsible for over a third of inmates in the federal system and nearly 20% of the 1.3 million people incarcerated in state prisons. Even more shocking than the numbers of people in prison for low-level drug offenses and for possession and sale is the enormous racial disparity in how it's applied. Despite comparable rates of illicit drug use, African Americans are 600% more likely to be incarcerated for drug crimes, and nearly 80% of people in federal prison and almost 60% of people in state prison for drug offenses are Black or Latino. This paradoxical relationship between a highly racialized regime of illegal drug prohibition and a highly commercial laissez-faire approach to pharmaceuticals cannot be understood without recourse to racial capitalism and how it structured pharmacological markets throughout American history. Historically, the fundamental division between dope and medicine was the race and class of alleged users. From its inception, illicit drug prohibition and the social hysteria that accompanied it have been enmeshed with racist ideas and practices. The earliest salvos in the American drug war can be traced to anti-opium ordinances in the late 19th century in California as Chinese laborers poured into the state during the railroad building boom. In 1914, the federal government passed the Harrison Narcotics Act, which taxed and regulated opiates and coca products. And I would just add that the background to this is, of course, the British Opium Wars, where Britain goes to war with China, forcing it to open up its markets, and forcing the Chinese to legalize opium. So ultimately, the people that are criminalized are migrants, but the kinds of imperial practices that led to the mass consumption of opium are untouched. In 1914, the federal government passed the Harrison Narcotics Act. Similarly, in the aftermath of the Mexican Revolution, as rates of immigration increased, Congress passed the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, which targeted the customs and culture of newly settled migrants. While, quote, cannabis was well known in the United States, as numerous tinctures and medicines contained the ingredient, a racial scare campaign swept the country, warning of the dangers of marijuana and arousing men of color's violent lust for white women. As bad as the early drug panics were, they paled in comparison to the carceral regime of drug prohibition and policing that emerged in the years after the civil rights movement. In the 1980s and 1990s, mass incarceration and the overlapping wars on drugs and gangs became de facto urban policy for impoverished communities of color in US cities. Legislation expanded state and federal mandatory minimums for drug offenses, denied public housing to entire families if any member was even suspected of a drug crime, broadened federal death penalty eligible crimes, and imposed draconian restrictions on parole. Ultimately, multiple generations of youth of color found themselves confined to long-term prison sentences and lifelong social and economic marginality. And one of the really ironic moments in Trump's speech in New Hampshire and also before the UN is that he threatens to provide the death penalty for high-level drug trafficking. So he threatens to do this, not understanding that it had already been written into law under the Clinton administration. Today, much of Donald Trump and Attorney General Jeff Sessions' rhetoric is taken from decades of drug and incarceration frenzies past, including the threat of the death penalty for drug trafficking under Bill Clinton, Just Say No campaign under Ronald Reagan, and the reinvigoration of the war on gangs, Bill Clinton. Quote, "We are all facing a deadly lucrative international trade," warned Jeff Sessions as he spoke before the International Association of Chiefs of Police in the fall of 2017. He laid out a law and order platform that promised to back the blue, reduce crime, and dismantle, quote, transnational criminal organizations. He drew so heavily, in fact, from 1980s drug hysteria that he earned giddy praise from Edwin Meese III, Ronald Reagan's attorney general during the most notorious years of the drug war. Quote, "Largely unnoticed has been the extraordinary work that Attorney General Jeff Sessions has done in the Department of Justice to create a Reagan-esque resurgence of law and order," argued Meese on the editorial pages of USA Today. Over the past 2 years, Trump and former Attorney General Jeff Sessions repeatedly used the threat of drugs and racial contagion for a reactionary portfolio ranging from reversals of modest criminal justice reform passed during the Obama era, including reinstating federal civil asset forfeiture, eliminating federal power to implement consent decrees at the local level, and the expansion of mandatory minimum sentencing in the federal system to the building of a separation wall. And although anti-crime rhetoric no longer has the same rhetorical purchase that it did in the era of Willie Horton or Ricky Ray Rector, thanks in large part to activist efforts to delegitimize mass incarceration, the reinvigorated machinery of criminalization remains firmly in place. And I just want to stress that the drug war is still marching forward. So even though there's been a discussion about the kinder, gentler response to opioids, the drug war is still absolutely in effect, and these kinds of machinery has been completely untouched, even if the public discourse is different. Integrating the opioid crisis with the war on drugs raises questions beyond familiar narratives and political discourse. In the United States, prohibition of illicit drugs and the mass marketing of illicit pharmaceuticals fit together in a larger framework of racial capitalism and deregulation that are deeply intertwined and mutually reinforcing. The opioid crisis would not have been possible without the racial regimes that have long structured both illicit and illicit consumption. The linguistic convention of white versus black markets points to how steeped our ideas of licit and illicit are in the meta-language of race. The demonization of urban non-white drug users played a crucial role in the opening up of white pharmaceutical markets in the 1990s that proved so enormously profitable to companies like Purdue Pharma, paving the way for our current public health crisis. In the 1990s, Purdue Pharma created aggressive marketing campaigns to convince doctors and state regulators of the safety of a new class of time-release opioid analgesics. Given their status as Schedule II controlled substances, this attempt to change policy faced enormous political pushback as the number of people being incarcerated for drug offenses was reaching an all-time high, with over 600,000 people imprisoned and two-thirds of those in the federal system and one half in state prison for drug crimes. However, a major shift had taken place in regulatory policy a decade before that made this possible. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan initiated a radical program of corporate deregulation that opened the door to a new era of pharmaceutical mass marketing. Reagan's second American Revolution slashed government oversight, pushed through expedited review by the Federal Drug Administration, the FDA, and for the first time allowed direct-to-consumer advertising for pharmaceutical drugs. So it's only the United States and New Zealand, these are the only countries in the world that allow this direct marketing to consumers for prescription drugs. Amazingly, the deregulation of pharma took place while the Reagan administration was launching its bombastic second war on drugs that established a new standard for illicit drug prohibition that his successors, George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, struggled not only to meet, but to exceed. This potent mix of racialized drug prosecution and corporate empowerment created the environment in which Purdue and other companies sought out new commercial strategies for marketing white opioids. So when Purdue introduced OxyContin in 1996, it proceeded with an awareness of both the opportunities and the potential pitfalls. In response, the company developed a number of marketing strategies to increase sales and to navigate the deeply segregated waters of drug consumption. In order to market OxyContin, a long-term release opioid that contained the active ingredient oxycodone, Purdue created an expansive network of sales representatives, doubling its staff from 318 in 1996 to 671 in 2000. Driven by sophisticated data collection methods that revealed the highest and lowest prescribers in every zip code throughout the United States, Purdue identified medical practices with the largest numbers of pain patients and with physicians who were the least discriminate prescribers. Sales representatives received bonuses ranging from $15,000 to $240,000 a year for increases in opioid prescriptions in their coverage areas, and they visited doctors repeatedly, drawing them into an elaborate informational marketing campaign. Purdue offered doctors educational conferences in Sunbelt resorts, patient coupons, OxyContin-themed plush toys, and even a music compact disc with the theme, quote, "Get in the Swing with OxyContin." This is not The Onion. The company's aggressive sales tactics convinced primary care doctors to prescribe opioids much more frequently for a wide range of patient complaints, including lower back pain and arthritis. By 2003, primary physicians made up nearly half of OxyContin prescribers. Some experts at the time worried that the primary care physicians lacked independent training in chronic pain management and addiction. Meanwhile, the increase in the sale of OxyContin from 48 million upon its introduction to 1.1 billion 4 years later demonstrates the enormous scale of this enterprise. According to public health scholars, Dr. Helena Hansen and Jules Netherland of Drug Policy Alliance, Purdue's success hinged not only on this intensely aggressive sales campaign, but also on racially bifurcated understandings of addiction. Drug sales representatives purposely directed advertisement to overwhelmingly white, suburban, and rural areas to avoid the stigma of racially coded urban drug markets. So a big part of the way they market these drugs is for a new class of users that are justified to regulators to say that they are very unlikely to become addicted. So this is where the race intersects with marketing. So it's this creation and kind of drawing lines around a new class of consumers that helps them to actually deregulate the selling of these intensely concentrated addictive medications. By crafting a geographically distinct white consumer base, understood as the antithesis of, quote, hardcore urban drug users targeted by the wars on drugs and gangs, the company both benefited from and reinforced the racial ideology underwriting punitive campaigns. Not surprisingly, the regions that initially showed the highest rate of opioid abuse in the early 2000s, including Maine, West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, and southwestern Virginia had overwhelmingly white populations. And one of the things I want to say about this paper is that I'm really talking about the genesis of the opioid crisis. I'm not talking about what it looks like today, because it's actually, the patterns are changing significantly, but this is going back to the late 90s to think about how did we end up with an opioid crisis, which in turn is changing. It's changing geographically, it's changing racially. So this is a snapshot from late 90s, early 2000s. Although the press termed OxyContin hillbilly heroin, narrating it as the drug of choice for poor whites, public health researchers have shown that affluent suburbanites also had higher rates of abuse. This is exemplified by Rush Limbaugh's disclosure of his own prescription opioid abuse in 2003. Racial disparities in healthcare access, discriminatory patterns among physicians, and a self-conscious strategy by pharmaceutical companies that cultivated, quote, legitimate white consumer markets, all contributed to the racial demographics of the early opioid crisis. One reason that pharmaceutical companies could market such powerful and largely untested sustained-release analgesics for non-malignant pain for long-term use was implicit assumptions about its intended consumers. Quote, the disproportionate uptake of OxyContin by rural and suburban prescribers in majority white states, Maine, Kentucky, and West Virginia, is notable in light of the historical hostility of regulatory agencies such as the DEA, argued Helena Hansen. Quote, urban markets would have brought with them race and class imagery of illicit use that may have expanded prescription of OxyContin for moderate pain, a hard sell to regulators. In a similar line of analysis, David Hertzberg, a pharmaceutical historian, places the opioid crisis in the larger sweep of American history. According to Hertzberg, there is no real difference between prescription medicines and illicit drugs. Both possess physical and psychoactive effects, but the social meaning attributed to them has more to do with race, class, and differential application of state power to pharmacology. The contemporary disparity between illicit and illicit has its origins in the Jim Crow era, when the Supreme Court enshrined the practice of separate but equal into law. In the years after World War II, the civil rights movement challenged racial discrimination in consumer markets, rendering the most overt forms of discrimination illegal, such as segregated lunch counters, public conveyances, and housing covenants. Although post-war social movements overturned the most visible forms of segregated consumption, the racialized division between licit and illicit drug markets has proved one of the most enduring. Indeed, it provides a primary rationale for the wars on drugs and crime that emerged after the Voting Rights Act. Today, African Americans and Latinos make up 80% of those incarcerated in federal prisons and 60% of those in state. One of the most compelling aspects of Hertzberg is his historical explanation of how white consumers in the post-war era defined themselves against racially coded urban drug users by redefining pharmacological relief as an entitlement. In the same period that Richard Nixon launched the first drug war, white consumers, steeped in the discourse of the silent majority, demanded access to pharmaceuticals as citizenship right. Quote, I as an American citizen demand at this writing to restore all the drugs that people need, argued a complaint to the FDA. Too many people are suffering and being penalized on account of drug abusers. This problematic social entitlement functioned as the flip side of a more familiar story of criminalization and divestment of black and brown populations in the wars on drugs, gangs, and crime. Prohibition required a space of white absolution that enabled incredibly profitable mass marketing campaigns of licit pharmaceuticals. Quote, a focus on pharmaceutical white market tells a very different story of a divided system of drug control designed to encourage and enable a segregated market for psychoactive substances. The regime established a privilege, maximal freedom of rational choice in a relatively safe drug market, and linked this privilege both institutionally and culturally to social factors such as economic class and whiteness. Cultural logics as well as criminal justice policy have also reinforced and animated the racialized boundary between licit health seekers and illicit pleasure seekers in the popular imagination. I would say both films and television shows about drugs are almost inevitably about racial fantasies. Iconic drug films such as Traffic and Requiem for a Dream dramatized the tragedy of white women's descent into illegal narcotic use through pornographic narratives in which innocent young white girls are coerced into interracial sex by black male pushers. Drawing on the cinematic grammar of Birth of a Nation, they reenact the white supremacist ideology that justified racial segregation. Looked at it in this way, the opioid crisis appears not as an unprecedented phenomenon, but the product of long-standing historical processes. The role of white absolution is even clearer when looking at the disparate consequences for illicit drug use across the color line. It is well known that the 1980s and 90s gave us both the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity for crack versus powder cocaine and the deregulatory origins of the opioid crisis. The Reagan administration, for example, ushered in the notorious direct-to-consumer advertising, which made it possible for pharmaceutical companies to bring their wares to television and print, thereby driving new circuits of consumer demand. However, nothing speaks more profoundly to how the state artificially constructed segregated drug markets than federal prosecutions for crack use. While many people are aware of the crack powder sentencing disparity, much lesser known is how few white people were ever charged with crack offenses by federal authorities. And this is despite the federal government's own survey data from the National Institute of Drug Abuse and NIDA documenting that over two-thirds of crack users in the United States during the same period were white. Even more shocking than the length of sentences for crack offenders was the enormous scale of racial disparity and how federal authorities applied the law in different regions of the country. Between 1986, when the Congress signed the Anti-Drug Abuse Act into law, and the passage of President Clinton's crime bill in 1994, not a single white person in many cities across the US was ever convicted of a federal crack offense. The list includes some of the largest metropolitan areas in the country, including Miami, Boston, Denver, Chicago, Dallas, and Los Angeles. Quote, out of hundreds of cases, only one white person was convicted in California, two in Texas, three in New York, and two in Pennsylvania, noted Los Angeles reporter Dan Weichel. Instead, prosecutors shunted their cases into the state system, which had much lower rates of conviction and shorter sentences. And I just want to stress, the difference between state and federal crack convictions is enormous. So only 2% of people in federal drug cases ever win their cases. And the amount of time is often 2 to 4 times as much. So you have the absolute most punitive dimension of the drug war being applied almost entirely to Black and Latino populations. At the heart of this inquiry is the paradoxical relationship between prohibition and provision, in which some of the harshest advocates for punishment, criminalization of illicit drug use, have also enthusiastically supported and defended pharmaceutical deregulation and expanded access to white opioids. If there's any doubt about Donald Trump's acquiescence to Big Pharma, despite his campaign that promised lower Medicare drug prices, one need look no further than his appointment of Alex Azar, the former president of Lilly USA, a subsidiary of the Indiana-based global drug giant Eli Lilly from 2012 to 2017, to serve as the secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. The career of Rudolph Giuliani is one of the best examples of this kind of cognitive dissonance about drug policy that can be little understood without recourse to the dynamics of racial capitalism. Embraced by the media as America's mayor for his performance during 9/11, Giuliani and his police commissioner, Bratton, were central architects of zero tolerance quality of life policing in New York City, which criminalized a number of low-level offenses ranging from panhandling and graffiti to illegal vending and minor cannabis possession. Giuliani's administration presided over nearly 40,000 marijuana arrests per year, up nearly 40-fold from New York City's historic cannabis possession rates in earlier decades. In fact, the highest number of marijuana possession arrests ever recorded in New York City took place under the Giuliani administration, with 51,267 arrested in the year 2000. Giuliani also led a vicious campaign against methadone treatment in the 1990s, advocating complete abstinence as the only acceptable response to illicit drugs. Given his hardline stance on drug prohibition, it is striking that 2 years after New York's all-time high in marijuana arrests, the former New York mayor and prosecutor took on Purdue Pharma as a client, agreeing to help the company fend off a federal investigation into improper marketing practices of the powerful sustained-release narcotic OxyContin. Quote, "There are tens of millions of Americans suffering from persistent pain," argued Giuliani. "We must find a way to ensure access to appropriate prescription pain medications for those suffering from the debilitating effects of pain while working to prevent abuse and diversion of those same vital medications." John Brownlee, a U.S. attorney from the Western District of Virginia, initiated an investigation into Purdue Pharma shortly after his federal appointment as he witnessed skyrocketing numbers of opioid overdoses and deaths in his region. Quote, "This was pushed by the company to be marketed in an illegal way, pushed from the highest levels of the company, that in my view made them a criminal enterprise that needed to be dealt with." Although the young attorney's legal action was the first and only successful criminal suit against Purdue, the company currently faces hundreds of civil suits from other states, including Texas, New York, Indiana, and Massachusetts. Giuliani provided Purdue with legal services as well as access to his extensive network of political connections in Washington, D.C. He finessed an agreement that kept senior executives from serving prison time, placed restriction on future prosecution of Purdue, and put non-disclosure agreements in place. The Guardian later claimed that his intervention had a definitive effect by negotiating a deal that, quote, "avoided a bar on Purdue doing business with the federal government, which would have killed a large part of their multi-billion-dollar market for the drug." So Giuliani does play this absolutely crucial role, and it's not just as lawyer, it's really as political broker. And it made it possible from 2001 to 2007, as this epidemic was taking off, to prevent any changes to Purdue's marketing practices. So he was absolutely central to this, you know, this deregulated sale and protection of large pharma. Activists, investigative journalists, and public sector attorneys have produced a significant body of work documenting the culpability of pharmaceutical companies in the contemporary opioid crisis. Until quite recently, however, this history has largely failed to reach the mainstream. And I'll just add that I wrote this piece in December, but it's been really wonderful to see just the takeoff of stories and prosecutions. You know, last fall when I was working on it, there was some discussion in the press about the culpability of pharmaceutical companies themselves. But up until this point, there's been much more focus on you know, bad apple prescribers, you know, irresponsible doctors, these, you know, pain pill centers, but very little focus on the kinds of structural marketing campaigns that were deployed by the pharmaceutical companies themselves. So it's been enormously heartening, largely because of the kinds of social protests that we've seen, including the Guggenheim protest that was undertaken, that's really highlighted the culpability of the pharmaceutical companies themselves. That's why we're hearing about it, not just the largesse of the press. Until recently, however, this history has largely failed to penetrate mainstream opinion. Despite the path-breaking investigative journalism of Barry Meyer's Painkiller and Chris McGill's American Overdose, popular exposés have frequently centered on the unethical practices by individual doctors and pill mills, rather than excavating how Purdue and other companies built a commercial infrastructure that revolutionized narcotic sale at enormous social cost. Culpability is shared by a resource-starved FDA and a regulatory infrastructure's failure to intervene when it became apparent that widespread drug abuse was taking place. Unfortunately, the young have been the hardest hit. The New York Times recently estimated that there are currently nearly 400,000 people addicted to prescription opioids or heroin in the age range from 18 to 25. Even more troubling is evidence that in states like Ohio and West Virginia, with the highest rates of prescription opioid consumption, the numbers of children assigned to foster care have increased rapidly, with between half and 80% of placements linked to substance abuse in the home. In the realm of health and human pain, free market fundamentalism has proved quite deadly. Resurrecting the origins of the opioid crisis in the illicit pharmaceutical market is urgent, not only to rethink the politics of deregulation, but also to counter the drug war narratives being mobilized by the Trump administration today. The demonization of vulnerable populations of color for our national ills, while absolving corporations of wrongdoing, has become the hallmark of our times. Powered by fantasies of racialized menace and national innocence, the state has sponsored militarized campaigns against migrants and refugees as the war on drugs continues unabated. In moving testimony before the House Judiciary Committee on Immigration and Border Security, distinguished Stanford University professor and West Virginia native Keith Humphreys, MD, spoke directly to this issue in February 2018. Quote, West Virginia is emblematic of where this epidemic is at its most destructive. Rural areas that don't have sanctuary cities, indeed generally do not have cities at all. Recent migrants are rare, yet opioid addiction is rampant. That's because the opioid epidemic was made in America, not in Mexico, not in China, or any other foreign country. The astonishing increase in providing opioids, which at its apex reached nearly a quarter of a billion prescriptions per year, is what started and still maintains our opioid epidemic. Prescription opioids come from American companies and are prescribed by American doctors, overseen by American regulators. Like many crises, our current dilemma also presents opportunities to radically rethink our approaches to both prohibition and provision. In addition to recognizing the role of pharma, a critical look at the opioid crisis also requires examining the larger environment in which this predatory marketing campaign took place. Structural issues of economic downward mobility, diminished occupational safety and health protections, lack of healthcare access, and the limitations of managed care have all contributed to the current epidemic. Equally important is pushing back against the racist logic that has long underwritten prohibition efforts while occluding and even assisting the pharmaceutical industry's attempt to expand its reach. Phantasms of drug and sale consumption continue to animate deeply felt national narratives, demarcating the line between white and black, native and foreign, innocence and guilt, medical versus recreational, deserving and undeserving, and yes, licit versus illicit. And be it nativist discourse about the opioid crisis or the unrelenting march of the war on drugs, the Trump administration, like its Democratic and Republican predecessors, has drawn some of its most destructive symbols of racial animus from its repertoire. One of the most important lessons to be learned from viewing the opioid crisis and drug war through the lens of racial capitalism is that the privileges of whiteness come at great social cost, not only for those excluded from them, but also for those who possess them. As our nation witnesses a significant drop in life expectancy due to high rates of suicide and overdose, an honest reckoning with the true nature of power and culpability in the U.S. has never been more urgent.